Unified with Momobo Ogoro. This is News Talk.
Unified. This is a show where we listen, learn and laugh and meet people from different and diverse communities all over Ireland to hear their stories and perspectives. I'm your host, Momobo Ogoro, and you can get in touch with Unified by emailing unified@newstalk.com. That's Unified with a Y-O-U. Coming up on today's show, our panel will discuss housing insecurity and whether some communities are disproportionately affected. We'll meet Chinese-Irish musician Ethan Holland, better known as Tozai. And on the social scene, we'll be diving into queer filmmaking with Gays LGBTQIA International Film Festival. But first, for many people, the fear of losing their home isn't just a one-off crisis. It's something that they live with every day, from the constant threat of eviction to the emotional turmoil of never feeling quite secure in your own house. Housing insecurity can shape people's mental health, their family life, and even future generations. So today we're exploring what it means to live with such a long-term insecurity, the risk of eviction. So joining me today to have that conversation is Anne-Marie O'Reilly, National Advocacy Manager at Threshold, and Threshold Advisor Kira Keeley. You're welcome, ladies.
Folks, I was just reading your Q2 impact report, and it's actually quite scary in terms of the rate of housing insecurity and the amount of people that are not only in precarious situations, but are seeking support. So, like, Anne-Marie, can you kind of tell us a bit more about, like, just what housing insecurity is and how many people are looking for it right now for supports in Ireland?
Mm-hmm. So housing insecurity, it's a situation where you don't necessarily know that you will get to remain in the home that you have. And most people in the rental sector experience this when their landlord decides to end the tenancy. However, even if you're with a landlord for many years, you get along really well with that landlord, there's a worry hangs over renters. Are they going to kick me out? Are they going to decide next month, do you know what, I'm going to retire, that's it, I'll send them the notice. And this is something we've seen a lot in our research. So that precarity hangs over renters quite a bit. And I suppose that's what we see come through our services, the people who have received the notices of termination and then people who are worried about receiving those notices of termination. But I will say there was a change in legislation on the 1st of March this year, which will shift that slightly. So for tenancies that began on or after the 1st of March, those are a guaranteed 6 years. It's only in very specific circumstances could a small landlord evict somebody during those 6 years. And large landlords won't really be able to evict people unless those people breach their agreement. So we hopefully in a few years will see that precarity lessen and people have that real feeling of security in their homes, in the private rental sector.
And that feeling of security, a lot of people really take that for granted when you are in that position where you either own your house or you're in a good rental agreement. And specifically, Kerry, I know you're an advisor in this work. Your report just recently said that you've prevented more than 1,100 people from entering homelessness. Can you tell us, like, what does the impact of that happen when it comes to people, and like how do they come to you?
So we get a good few queries from, I suppose, a variety of contact channels. So there's a lot of people that will contact us via our helpline, via our query form online, and just get in touch with us kind of via email with their documents and with their worries and their concerns. So in relation, to, I suppose, to protecting tenancies, a lot of that might happen with regards to notices of termination. So our team of advisors will review notices that are served to tenants, be it for a rent increase, rent setting, or to end the tenancy. And we will make sure that, you know, we will review those and see, did the landlord, you know, meet their obligations and serve the notice in line with what's required in legislation? So we can give advice to tenants on that, so they have options on what choices they make and what decisions they have, and they have the information to be empowered to go back to their landlords with that information as well. Our advisors will also try to support people in accessing social welfare payments, grants that they might be eligible for, especially when, you know, with the cost of living crisis, everyone's talking about things are extremely expensive, and it's very easy for people to just fall into arrears and fall into small amounts of arrears in some cases. But again, with rents being so high, some people missing one rental payment could be missing $2,500, which is no small amount of money and very hard to claw back. So again, our advisors trying to support tenants and renters and reviewing their kind of their finances, the rent setting, has that done accurately, will really help support, kind of look at the holistic picture of someone's rent experience. So it's not just, you know, people don't come just with the one issue. There could be more if you pick and poke away at it and try to peel back kind of the history of their experience within the rental market.
What really struck me when you were saying there is that giving people that sense of power, a lot of people don't recognise that, like, information is a source of power, and mm-hmm. what you guys are doing is providing the people with the adequate information to be empowered to fight for themselves, essentially. And I suppose when it comes to the people that you work with, Anne-Marie, are there communities that are disproportionately affected by housing insecurity or the people that you're engaging with through your research?
Mm. So I suppose on the broad face of it, the people who come to us for assistance come from all across society. You know, we publish the figures on age, family status, income levels. So just for example, about 37% of people who come to us are single individuals. Then about another 40% are families, whether that's one or two parent families. Strangely enough, we don't see many people aged 18 to 24 come to us. And, you know, a lot of people think renting, oh, young people, students, young workers going out on their own for the first time. One of the reasons we don't see many of them is probably because a lot of them can't move out of the family home.
Still living at home.
Yeah, they're still living at home. So that's part of the reason we're seeing them a little bit less. But what I guess it comes to an issue arising in the tenancy, maybe a young person without children might be a little bit more mobile. They can get up and leave, maybe go find somewhere else, maybe go stay with a friend for a while, maybe go back to the family home. Where it becomes quite difficult is, so single parent families can face particular challenges. So financially, they can be up against it and trying to afford a place. Sometimes they can be discriminated against. Landlords, some landlords may not be inclined to rent to them, you know, for stigma. There can be stigma associated being a single parent family. And then families in general, sometimes landlords might look and go, oh,
why families?
Bunch of kids, they're going to be messing up the place. Okay. There's a greater chance of more wear and tear on the property. Mm. Markers on the wall, things broken and things and whatnot. And then beyond that, again, in some research we did a few years ago, we will see those people who are generally more marginalised in society. So as I said, single parents, lower income, people of migrant background tend to find it much tougher, much more difficult in the rental sector. Partly because of discrimination that exists, the financial challenges involved, and then not having maybe the community or network of supports to rely on. So while a lot of rental properties are advertised online, other people hear about them through word of mouth as well. And then it has been some time, but you will see every now and again in the media reports about overcrowding. And you very often will see that's migrant workers who are here maybe on work study visas or things like that, who are they are looking for somewhere cheap and affordable to move into, and usually in the hopes of getting somewhere better. But it can end up there much longer than planned, and they end up in quite overcrowded and unsafe conditions and still paying a nice bit of money for those places. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they're definitely in the rental sector. There are people who are more vulnerable.
And are those places even legal to operate? Because it's quite unsafe conditions as well.
So this is something that's only come up recently. It comes up frequently for ourselves, but only recently we were speaking about it again in Threshold about this overcrowding. So there's no legal definition of overcrowding for private rental properties. Mm. There are fire safety requirements. So if there was a concern that a place is so overcrowded that people wouldn't be able to exit safely during a fire, the fire services can go in and give, you know, direction and, you know, maybe order changes to be made or things like that. But it is a difficult one, because even when it comes to minimum standards, the local authorities have authority there. Nobody wants to be shutting down or getting rid of accommodation when there's so little accommodation. But it's vital that safety isn't set to one side in those instances. So, yeah, it's a delicate balance. And then those types of places where, let's say, there is very severe overcrowding to the point of it being unsafe, the relevant authorities often don't know about them. Somebody has to complain or put their hand up and go, no, there's a problem here. But people are often reluctant to do that, because where will they go?
Yeah.
So it's difficult.
It's a very difficult situation. And I'll bring you in, Kira, because, like, as you're advising people, I'm sure that, like you were saying, it's much more than just like the money situation. Mm-hmm. It's a holistic thing. There's a huge psychological impact when it comes to these people and what they're experiencing. Can you describe to us what that psychological impact is?
I think there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of anxiety within the private rented sector and renting in general. If you're even in accommodation, fear to report issues to your landlord, fear to question the rent that's been set, fear to ask for something to be replaced, for fear of seeming like a difficult tenant, where, you know, it's your obligation if there's an issue to report to the landlord, and that's an expectation. But again, people's experiences, they may have negative ones, might impact that long term, especially when people are renting for 10, 15 years. I suppose any kind of negative treatment in the past definitely does transpire through. And then we see again with people who have experienced homelessness in the past, be it in homeless shelters, be it, you know, staying on a couch of friends and family, sleeping rough. These are all situations that do pass on and continue on years after the incident. So when someone comes and has a notice, although there might be, you know, 6-9 months of notice on it, with people with that experience before and with that anxiety about having to move and find somewhere else, where it may have ended in a negative situation previously, It's very difficult, I suppose, for those people to see that there might be a positive ending or an outcome, because I suppose the worst has happened to them previously, and it's hard to get out of that mindset, especially when there's not very much choice. And, you know, before, if you were unhappy in accommodation or someone wasn't treating you well in accommodation, you know, you might have been able to say, look, I'm going to give notice, there's a breach here on the landlord side and I'm going to vacate. A lot of people don't have that option anymore, so they're stuck living in poor environments, negative, you know, interactions with their landlords, and there's no option for those people to leave and vacate and move somewhere else. Or if there is an option, it could be far beyond what their budget would allow.
And does this happen like across like generations as well when it comes to that psychological impact, you know?
I think so. We would have some adults contacting our service who might have experienced living in a family hub, a homeless hub for families and children when they were younger. I've had some experience with that myself. And again, the fear of going back into a position like that, even, you know, when they're after, you know, going into education, having a job and kind of really trying to move beyond on that in themself to be more safe and have a secure environment, that definitely does transpire through. And I suppose we would see also situations where, you know, I think we underestimate how safe home ownership may make people feel, even if it's a case of a family member having a home, that mm-hmm. we're seeing lots of parents and their children living with their, you know, grandparents or with, you know, adult children. And it means that, you know, instead of maybe 2 or 3 people being at risk of homelessness when a tenancy ends, you could have 8 or 9 altogether who are relying on that accommodation as a whole unit. So it does kind of, I suppose, dramatise kind of the issues when there are so many people relying on one accommodation because there's limited access or limited affordable access as well.
And it's a very sort of, it's so uncertain in terms of just how people are managing this, not only physically, but psychologically as well. And you were saying in that piece of just like home ownership is a sense of stability. Do you believe that people should like strive towards home ownership? Can I ask you that, Anne-Marie?
So we'd like to see renting on a similar level as home ownership or a social housing or cost mm-hmm. rental. So that it's got that same level of security. Now, I don't know if it ever, a lot would have to happen, I guess, for it to be on a level with it. So that's why actually in Threshold, and not just ourselves, many other organisations and the Housing Commission that did its work there a couple of years ago, have advocated for a unitary housing system.
What does that mean?
So it means that 20% of all of our housing stock would be delivered as social housing or cost rental housing or affordable housing. And the rest would be through private rental or private home ownership. And the 20% is quite an important figure because it's when affordable housing reaches that level, it tips the balance and it tips the market slightly, and it forces the private market to become competitive. And by it, and the, so the private market has to give a better offering than what the affordable sector can. So that's either better prices, better terms, better security, better choice. And so The whole housing system would have to change to that for renting to really have that level of security.
Can I ask, where do you know where we're at now in terms of the...
We're about 11%.
Okay, a long way to go.
Yeah, it will take a long time, and it'll take each and every subsequent government working toward that and committed to that. And I know certainly the current government do wish to see 20% of output during their term be on that affordable side of things. But there's a lot of catch-up involved. So that will take a long time. However, we have the likes of cost rental now. So that's where the rent is based on the cost of delivering the property. Now, it is pegged also to market rent. It's meant to be at least 25% less than market rent. And so the housing agency did do some research on this last year, talking with people who live in cost rental, and how they spoke about living there is how people speak about owning their own home. That's security. I'm here now for life. This is our place. I can paint it. I can pick the furniture, you know, whatever that may be. There was still an inclination among some to go on to buy. But I guess that's because historically that's how you got security in Ireland when it came to housing. And I think as cost rental becomes more established, we'll see that begin to shift. But the general aspiration among people is to buy because that's secure. But we see from our surveys of renters, we did an all-island survey of renters there last year. While the greater part do want to buy, only a small amount of them believe it will happen. You know, so the
and what's the gap there in terms of the belief and wanting?
I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think maybe something like one in three who would like to buy actually think they will get to buy. But that's where we need to have these other options available to people. Yeah.
And it's really stark in terms of even that long way, that 11% to 20% where we have to go in order for the market to kind of skew and shift, because it is like we are living in a housing crisis, and it's important for people to not only have houses that they can afford, but have that sense of safety, security. Your home is basically the place that you can land and rest your head. Yes. So it's quite boggling to see how certain people are treated and to see the insecurity that's out there. And I suppose for yourself, Ciara, in terms of what people are saying, or what are the most common things that you're hearing as an advisor?
One of the main things that come through is, I suppose, the fear of a landlord ending a tenancy. And then I suppose alongside that, standards issues within a property, they'll coincide. And you will hear situations and stories from people who, you know, have wanted to make their rental accommodation their home and have done improvements and tried to make it better, and they'll get served with a notice. And I suppose it's the great disappointment that follows then, that, you know, this was somewhere that they were kind of putting down roots and that they were setting up in their community, and they were making connections. And it's not just the home that is pulled from them then, it's their surroundings and it's the connections that they've built. But then again, to go back to the standards issues, and with that fear of communicating issues to landlords, be it right or wrong, you know, there could be, you know, a lot of people out there willing to make the changes. But again, it's just, you know, giving people the courage and the empowerment to actually make those questions and know what they're entitled to. We're seeing, I suppose, a lot of, it's still summer, so for the meantime, it's okay. But we'll see a lot of damp in the next few months, a lot of heating costs, a lot of insecurity around, especially remembering there was the freeze last year, water and access to water and heating could absolutely be something that will come into play. So there's a lot of that comes across. Again, insecurity then about rents and rents being reset. A concern that has come up a couple of times as well is regarding now with the new legislation of rents being able to be reset in between tenancies. There's very little that a tenant can do to guarantee that the amount of rent they're being informed is an accurate reflection. So in some situations, when there's a new tenancy, a landlord's not meant to increase the rent to market rate. And in some cases, they can increase it to market rate. So that differentiation is meant to be communicated to tenants, you know, at the beginning of the tenancy, how much is being set at, what the situation is. And their only way of kind of going back to challenge that is to challenge it officially via dispute. There's no official point where a tenant can request that information, that historical data from the Residential Tenancies Board. And I suppose the fear,
so there's no like hub or anything that you can just say, hey, this is the area,
this is my tenancy, and give those details and that information be accessible. So I suppose when we're talking about the likes of, you know, home ownership or cost rental being based off market rate, we are seeing rents, you know, increase, and, you know, in some cases it can be quite drastic. And in some areas, mortgages might be cheaper than rent if people would be able to access the mortgage. You know, you could have people paying 600, 700, 800 plus more for their rented accommodation than the mortgage might cost. So all of that coming together, you know, people are really paying extraordinary amounts. And I suppose it has kind of the impact of maybe being kind of a two-tier system with the information and how people might feel about being able to trust the information that they're being given. So yeah, it can, they're kind of some of the main things, rents and rents being reset when it was a 2% cap. And when that does work, it can be smaller amounts, but definitely for rent resetting, you could be talking hundreds in the difference between a couple of tenancies. So that is definitely an area of concern.
That's crazy. And it's quite scary, and for people to really be aware and to know their rights and know that they have the capacity and even the administrative load of going to the officials to get the documents and seeing the history. And I suppose, like, what are the things, Emma and Marie, that people need to be aware of? What are the rights that people, generally speaking, don't know in terms of tenancy and housing and insecurity there?
So there's probably one that a lot of us probably would never think about when we're renting, and that is that you have a right to privacy. And the landlord can't just rock up at the door anytime they want. And if the landlord does want to call around, they have to get in touch with you and arrange that. And if that time doesn't suit you, then they can't just come in while you're not there. Let's say, because a lot of landlords or estate agents, letting agents will want to do inspections. They can't just come and do that when you're not home. So that's first and foremost. So that's your right to peaceful and exclusive occupation is actually what it's called. So that's to begin with. And then if a landlord does want to end a tenancy, they have to provide certain paperwork. They can't just send you a text. They can't mention it to you while they're chatting to you on the doorstep. They have to send it in writing, and it has to come with certain paperwork depending on the reason as to why they're ending it. Then the same if they want to increase the rent. It has to be in a specific format. And you know, all these templates and formats are available on the Residential Tenancy Board website. So it's not hugely challenging for someone to go get those and do them accordingly. And like Kira said, they have to set out, well, this is what the rent was, this is what the rent is going to be, and give the rationale and methodology for that, because there are certain rules around that. Your property can be inspected by the local authority to make sure it meets minimum standards. You can go to the local authority if you feel it doesn't meet minimum standards and ask them to undertake an inspection. So those are just kind of some of the basic ones that people don't know about. And then you can always ring us and find out, well, what am I allowed to do this? Is the landlord allowed to do that? What can I expect with this? You don't have to necessarily do anything with that information there and then, but you have it. And then if need be, you can go down the road of a dispute with the Residential Tenancies Board, or you can do mediation with the Residential Tenancies Board to try and resolve an issue that comes up with the landlord. Yeah.
And that's necessary information. And even that right to privacy, a lot of people aren't aware of that. They just think, oh, it's the person's house. They can definitely come in. But like, you are the person living in the house. This is your space. Mm-hmm. And you usually have the rights to be told when they are coming in. Are there any sort of just quick tips that we can give the listeners here to start protecting themselves when it comes to their own tenancies? What are the things that they need to have in top of mind?
So you may have a written agreement with your landlord. It's important to remember that regardless of what's in that agreement, it has to be in line with the Residential Tenancies Act. So you might sign something that contains a waiver of your rights and protections under the Act. Doesn't mean you've lost them. So that's first and foremost. Also, even if you don't have a written agreement, you are still protected by the Residential Tenancies Act. If an issue arises, you can still go to the RTB. Same if your tenancy isn't. So all tenancies are meant to be registered with the RTB. Don't worry if it isn't. You can still go to the RTB for a dispute. If the landlord hasn't registered the tenancy, they cannot access the RTB for an issue. So there's just some things to be going. You are protected regardless to whether you have something in writing or not, regardless as to whether the tenancy is registered or not. And then it's also important to know there is another group of renters called licensees. And that's a wide array of renters who are not protected by the legislation. Mostly not protected by the legislation. So sometimes people sign agreements that say license agreement at the top, but what they're actually in is a tenancy agreement. So it's always important to check that. And if you're not sure, you can give Threshold a ring and talk it through with the advisor.
Thanks a million to Anne-Marie O'Reilly and Ciara Keeley of Threshold. And if today's conversation raised any questions on your own housing situation, remember you can get the support of Threshold as they offer free confidential advice to renters across Ireland. You can free phone them at 1-800-454-454 from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Mondays to Fridays. Or you can book an appointment on their own outreach clinics around the country through their website at threshold.ie. Coming up after the break, we'll talk to a Chinese-Irish musician who reflects on their own identity through their music. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. Now, what does belonging mean to you? Well, on What's Your Story today, we're joined by Ethan Holland, better known as Tozai, who's a Chinese-Irish musician from Bangor up in the north. And he'll be discussing what identity, belonging, and just a sense of vulnerability and home, what that all means through his music. Welcome, Ethan. How are you?
Hiya. Yeah, all good. Happy to be here.
Now, can you explain to us how you got into the world of music and into the world of artistry?
Yeah. 100%. I started music probably when I was about 8, sort of got into piano lessons through my dad and just learned it classically. So I was quite classically trained from a young age. Worked up all the way through the grades and stuff. And it wasn't until I found playing guitar in high school that was when I sort of experienced a sort of want for creating my own songs, because playing piano was very much just playing other composers' pieces, and I find that the guitar allowed me to explore the instrument more creatively. That got me into the songwriting as well, and I guess it was always just in my bedroom for a long time, just writing music for myself that no one was really going to hear. And it wasn't until just before lockdown in 2020, I think 2019, 2020, I saw some local gigs, first time being in a local gig in Belfast. And I saw bands like Problem Patterns and Sasha Samara and Sister Ghost. And just seeing the local music scene sort of made pursuing music feel like a possibility. So after that, I felt really inspired to write my own stuff and have a sort of want to perform. And obviously lockdown happened, so that gave me a lot of time to write stuff.
It sounds very inspiring to see how you the journey in terms of how you got the courage to actually create your own work from playing classical music to then being inspired by other artists and the gigs that you saw to actually do your own work and do your own music and be your own artist. And I suppose the name Tozai, where did that come from?
Yeah, so Tozai comes from Tozai, which is Cantonese for bunny. And that sort of the bunny imagery or rabbit imagery is very much present in Chinese folklore with the jade rabbit on the moon, which is celebrated for Moon Day. And it's also just having been raised in Ireland all my life, just taken some folklore from that side as well, the hare. So just sort of that imagery was really the inspiration into the shift for that name.
That's nice. And I didn't know that Tozai meant or bunny or a rabbit or a hare. And it kind of ties in the two cultural aspects of it. And how do you tie those two cultural aspects of your identity into your music?
I think a lot of the lyricism, especially with Tiger Song, that very much was the first song to really explore something deeply personal in terms of how being brought up here made me feel and how I wanted people to connect with the song as well. Just sort of try and find that belonging and navigating that dual sense of cultural identity. Definitely a journey.
And what was that journey like?
The journey was, I guess it wasn't always an easy road. I think growing up was definitely, I guess growing up when you're a kid and when you're in your early teens, you never really find that sort of, I guess you're already struggling to find who you are as a person, first of all. And then balancing that as well with like the cultural identity, like being asked if you're a Protestant or Catholic Chinese, and you're like, well, just Hong Kong Chinese being brought up here, Irish, and just sort of facing discrimination from a very young age as well, and dealing with ignorance from other people certainly gives you sort of perspective on how things, you know, can be like growing up here. It's not always bad, and there's always room for improvement, and especially with the protests that have been happening in recent years. For example, in the summer last year and not so long ago in Belfast, things can tend to look like it's turning in the wrong direction. But I think the with my songs especially, and the community that I've been sort of brought up in, and the community that I've found, and the people that I surround myself with, there's definitely places for support amongst these things, and there's always something to look forward to despite all that's going on.
I suppose that the difficulty in going through that journey as a child and self-actualization, I'll say, process can be quite hard. So I just want to commend you for your own journey. And I suppose what I'm assuming, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the songs like Tiger Song and the other works that you've written has been a process, an emotional process in uncovering a lot of those feelings. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of the songwriting and the lyrics that I come up with do all sort of stem from personal places. Yeah, with the new song that came out, Too Bad, that sort of touched upon allowing yourself to be vulnerable in that sense, and sort of deals with the mental struggles that some people may face, and how that it's beneficial to reach out to people and not sort of carry everything on your own shoulders all the time, as much as you feel like you may have to. But yeah, that's pretty much that.
It's really hard to have to feel like you have to carry things on your shoulders, and that the expression that you're explaining with songwriting, with your art in general, sounds like a huge weight off your shoulder. And it's a weight that many people have to carry, like you said, in terms of that fear of being vulnerable, that fear of that they're the only one, or being alone, or that fear of even being othered in a space that they call their home. So it sounds like you're doing really great work, Ethan. And I want to ask you, like, your work kind of draws from sounds of like 90s alternative rock and things like that. What are some artists that influence your work? You've done the lyrics, but now the actual sound itself, who inspires you in that sense?
Yeah, definitely that sort of 90s alternative was really inspired through just the CDs that my parents would have had. And that's how I actually learned guitar mostly, was by putting on CDs and following it by ear, picking up the guitar parts from what they were playing. We had CDs for the likes of Cranberries, growing up, Smashing Pumpkins, Garbage as well would have been one of them. And I think I've just sort of, having listened to those type of bands throughout my childhood, has really inspired the sound that we have now. And I guess we have that sort of 90s alternatives foundation, but it's also mixed with a bit of modern indie bands as well. For example, like Blonde Shell would be one of my favorite artists, and Fontaine's DC, another one to mention too.
That's super cool. And I think it's nice that you draw your work from inspiring artists past and present to really create a new sound. And that ultimately that is how the creative process works. You draw from everything within your life, your experience,
yeah,
your the people that inspire you, and everything, that to create something new and to create something that is fresh for people to relate with and for people to draw from themselves. And I suppose you evolved, Tozai evolved from like a solo project to the band. Has that changed the creative process at all?
I suppose it's a bit more collaborative. now. I still write all lyrics, and sort of the startings of all the songs really just happen maybe like late at night when I get a idea, and it's all played. Usually starts with the acoustic guitar idea, because that's just what I immediately pick up, and ideas flow from there. And it's when I bring these forward to band, and Danny, he really makes it great with the drum tracks, because it's the one instrument that I can play. So yeah, I think having those initial ideas and then bringing them forward to band, and that really transforms it from like an early acoustic guitar demo to what you would hear in our recordings, where it's a full big band kind of sound.
And I suppose, what are your hopes for the band as you move forward? Is there any gigs or anything that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, we would love to play a few more festivals. We'd love to play in Hong Kong eventually, where my family's from, just to get a bit of connection from their home as well, as I've not been in Hong Kong for 16 years now. So I assume a lot has changed by now. It'd be really interesting to see what the music scene is like over there as well.
Well, thanks a million, Ethan, for coming on the show and sharing your artistry and your work with us. And after the break, we'll be talking about queer filmmaking with the Gays International Film Festival on the social scene. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. Now, the Gays International LGBTQIA Film Festival is back, bringing together 7 days of bold and boundary-breaking cinema to Dublin. This is until Monday, the 3rd of August. And I am joined by James Huston, who's a programmer at the festival, to chat about why we need to hear and see more queer filmmaking. Welcome, James. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited.
The festival sounds phenomenal. Can you tell us what it is?
Yeah. So Gays is Ireland's sort of premier LGBT film festival. It's been running since before homosexuality was decriminalized in Ireland. So since, I think, 92, I believe. And yeah, it's a festival celebrating the sort of most exciting and boldest and most creative new work by queer filmmakers, and sort of bringing together Ireland's film-loving community and LGBTQIA communities to just celebrate, like, having a really good time in the cinema.
And that's beautiful. And, like, why does a festival like this need to happen?
I would say it's like there's sort of two halves of that. There's what film festivals can do for filmmakers, and there's what film festivals can do for audiences. I think for filmmakers, it's a really exciting opportunity for people to have their work connect with new audiences. For Irish filmmakers especially, it's like really exciting to have an opportunity to show their work in a queer context, because, you know, your film can read completely differently if you're showing it in a queer film festival, in an Irish film festival, and in an international film festival. And then for audiences, it's really important that it happens because there's just incredible films. And there's so many films in the world, obviously. And the more film festivals we have, the more opportunities for audiences to get to see these films. Like this year, we have everything from brand new work from Pedro Almodovar to screening a 35mm screening of Bound, which will be happening tomorrow. So, yeah, it's really important to have festivals like this to celebrate, like, what the queer community is doing out of joy and creativity, and not just out of sort of sheer survival, especially in really sort of like difficult times. I think it's really important to have a place where we can come together and see what we can do when we have the capacity to, you know, sort of live beyond just existing and to create wonderful art that brings us all together.
That's beautiful. And film festivals are a huge way of just like, not only artistry, but like seeing into another world.
For sure.
Without boundaries, I guess, you mm-hmm. know? And like, I know the films that are in the festival are coming from 20 countries.
Yes.
Is there any sort of themes or sort of things that you've seen across the year that are changing right now in terms of what these storytellers are saying?
Yeah, I think there's a push for films to be, every year they're more exciting, they're more boundary pushing. Every year, I think filmmakers are less concerned with creating work that will have to sort of appeal to the widest possible audience. And in that process, it can happen that a film sort of loses what makes it specific to that filmmaker, what makes this filmmaker's concerns a part of their work. And I think we're seeing more and more work that reflects the intersections between different marginalized communities. So we have a really incredible film called Joy Boy, a tribute to Julius Eastman, that really celebrates sort of the intersection between queerness and blackness. And we have a film, our closing film is Yarapeo, which is a film by a non-binary filmmaker that's from Mexico that's exploring masculinity and queerness. And there's sort of all these different things that I think in the past people have had to sort of sand off their edges sometimes and maybe like not bring their fullest self. But in this time where there's so much backlash against queer life and queer rights, I think it's really exciting to see film that is just throwing that all to the wind and saying, this is what I want to make. This is the most exciting, uninhibited, like real thing I want to put out there. And it just makes for incredible art.
That's incredible to hear and to see. That's the dynamic is changing and people are becoming bolder and brighter with their artistry and with their voices. And have you noticed, in terms of the filmmakers that you're working with or engaging with, have their work been supported to the same capacity as other filmmakers? Is there a shift or a difference or similarities?
It so depends on the country, I guess. You know, there's completely different funding landscapes in all different parts of the world. And the main thing I do at GAZE is the short film programming. I think I can't speak to like specifically how this has happened, but I have noticed that I'm seeing more films in the short films each year from countries that were not showing up in the festival before. We have more South Asian films every year, which I'm really excited to see because we have a partnership with the Queer Spectrum Film Festival, which is part of Queer Asian Pride Ireland. And so it's really great to see that. I can't say exactly why that is happening specifically in those countries' respective like funding structures, but I definitely think there must be something going on that I hope that filmmakers are getting adequate support to sort of bring their entire selves to the table. And yeah, I think in Ireland there's a really incredible wealth of like queer filmmaking talent. And I just only hope that the funding landscape will be there to sort of support them and help them get their career to the next level after they've screened at GAZE.
And do you think that, like, when it comes to the audiences in terms of how they receive it, are people looking for queer stories, or is it something that is difficult to engage with beyond the festival?
I don't know. I think there is an element of the idea of like a queer film as separate from anything else that's in the cinemas is going away a little, which I think is great. I think if you are someone who wants to see queer film, there's more opportunities than ever to see it, whether that's out of festivals, whether that's at the GAZE Film Festival, Queer Spectrum Film Festival, the Tite Film Festival. Like Dublin specifically has this wealth of film festivals that are platforming the Red Umbrella Film Festival also. So yeah, there's more opportunities at festivals. And I think outside of that, yeah, it's wonderful to see more queer filmmakers like Jane Schoenburn's new film is just coming out, and stuff like Cara Holmes's film Lesbian Lines. Yeah, there's more work by queer filmmakers reaching cinemas, and I think it's sort of becoming known for just being good cinema, you know. So I hopefully this isn't wishful thinking, but I think that there's sort of less of a distance in audience now, that people aren't looking at a film and saying, this is a queer film, I can't go see it if I'm straight or if I'm not queer. That people are just looking at a film and saying, that looks like a good film, I'm going to go see a good film.
Well, that's great to hear. And it's great to see that, like, you're really pushing audiences to, within the festival, to kind of explore different like strands. Like what I was reading was like, you have some like thrill me, move me, push me. Why did you choose that in general?
So the strands are like, it's kind of a nice way to be able to find things that sort of reflect your interest in the festival, because obviously there's so many good films in the festival. And I think sometimes you're like, I don't know, like, I don't know these films. These are new films. These are premieres. So audiences sometimes can be like, where do I even start? And I think the strands are a great way to sort of narrow down that scope. So, for example, Move Me is films that will sort of get to your emotions, whether you like to laugh or to cry. And Thrill Me is obviously thrillers and things that might like get your blood pumping. And then Push Me is films that were sort of pushing boundaries of like, what makes a queer film? What does that look like? And Watch Me is about what it's like to be a queer person in public life and sort of like in, you know, a world where like everything is very much under surveillance at the moment. So those are all just different interests that audiences can kind of bring to the festival. And then we're sort of hoping to meet people halfway and say like, these are things that people seem to be interested in. These are things that people are excited about. And these are the films that we are bringing to them that appeal to that.
And it's a great way to actually take the decision making out of it, because when you just have a lot, you're like, oh my God,
it's tough.
Fatigue.
100%. Like, I think decision paralysis is something that like I deal with.
Same. I'm like, oh, tell me what to do. Tell me what to watch.
It's so tough. Like, I know that I feel that like at home just trying to pick a film. So, you know, everyone who runs the film festival is also, you know, just a normal person. And we also, you know, in our own time, we're like, what do I go see? There's too many options. So it's a way that like some people will browse the entire festival program and they will like read every single event in detail and then decide what are the things that they want to go to. And some people are like, I need something a little more focused. What do you suggest? And we put so much love and work and effort into the curating. So we're more than happy to suggest to people what to go to.
And thank you for that love and effort, because people like me that don't like making decisions, we're just like, they just tell me what to watch. Tell me what to do. And specifically, like, your hopes for the festival and even for wider audiences that may not be from the LGBTQ plus community watching these stories, what is that hope for the festival itself?
There's like the micro and the macro, and like the, I think the big picture is things that we're all probably familiar with, which is wanting people to connect with experiences outside of their own and wanting people to engage with art that sort of tells them more about the world. And, you know, for people who are being reflected in that art, that they might feel seen, that they might feel like a part of a community to have their experiences reflected. But also on the micro level, you want people to have a good time. I think that's a big hope for me is as the shorts programmer. Those are the two things I'm keeping in mind is I want the festival program to sort of have a message and to be not like settling for things that are exclusively easy and palatable and comfortable, and to find films that will be new experiences for people and that might push at their buttons sometimes and that like might get them thinking or put them out of their comfort zone. But I also am trying to pick films that I'm like, oh, people are going to love this. Like, it's very important to also have films in the program that I just think are a good time, that are funny, that are weird, that are exciting, that just, if I was going to a film festival and I sat down and I watched this, I would leave the screen going, that was great. I'm so glad that I saw that.
That's fantastic. And it sounds like a wonderful event for anybody to participate in. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing more about it.
The last two screenings will be tomorrow, which will be Bound on 35mm, which will be happening in the Lighthouse, and our closing film, Yarapeo, which will be happening in the IFI, which will also have a remote Q&A with the directors also afterwards. And then if anybody wants to keep up, we're obviously at gaze.ie and at Gaze Film Fest on socials, and we'll be back next year.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, James. It's lovely having you.
Thank you so much.
Now, folks, you can find out more about the Gaze International LGBTQIA Film Festival at gaze.ie. That is gaze, gaze.ie. And that brings us to the end of today's show, folks, on Unified. This show is supported by Commission a Man. Find us on podcasts on the Go Loud app and share your thoughts with us at unified@newstalk.com. Thank you to Marais O'Sullivan for producing and Aisha Nelvi on research. Join us again next week for more on Unified, Sundays at 8 p.m. on News Talk. See you then.